obtain and distribute briefly from your program and degrees, including a BS in management from BYU and an MBA from New York University and an MBA in religion from Yale. A couple of brief housekeeping notes. You've probably already heard this if you've been to any panels, but first off, take your cell phone and please put it into the silent or vibrate position. Second, welcome and thank you for attending our session. I should have said that first. Third, this is being recorded, so bear in mind that things which you say are being recorded on the recording device. When we do move to Q&A, please come up and say your question into the microphone, which will allow it to be recorded more effectively. And finally, please make sure to visit our book table if you want to purchase any of the books that are available, which there are a number of wonderful books available. And on that note, I will turn the time over to our presenter, Seth Payne.
Could not be reconciled to some of the church's specific doctrinal and historical claims. I sought out to answer some of my questions and thought that perhaps I was missing some key bits of information or the statement was triggered in my mind to have concerns for issues that really had no bearing whatsoever. Of course, the real problem was that these issues, these square pegs, as it were, ended up distracting me from my spirituality and my ability to enjoy true worship of the Lord as I kept trying to make them fit into the round doctrinal walls of Mormonism. What I struggled with at the time is how my spiritual experience could be authentic and my testimony real while these specific issues of history and doctrine were undeniably just as real. It was at this point that the language of my prayers had been re-changed significantly. No longer did I ask, is the Book of Mormon true, or did Joseph Smith truly receive the writings of Abraham, to simply, where do you want me to serve? The answer, quite clearly, was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. To this day, I'm a proud member of this church, and in many ways consider myself to be a liberal Protestant Mormon. Having grown up in the church, my faith was rooted in the testimony of things understood to be absolute truth supported by a tangible reality. Yet my new, fragile, and loosely defined density of both God and metaphysics was anything but tangible, and I struggled with reconciling my desire to serve as a Latter-day Saint with this emerging worldview. In my newfound faith, meaning does not necessarily require an association with the actual occurrence of a particular event. For example, even were Jesus to be a completely fictional character who never exists in reality, a position I do not hold, he still holds significant meaning in my spiritual life. Paradoxically, today I know less about Jesus than I once did, meaning that I can no longer testify I know Jesus was born of a virgin and resurrected. But I feel the power of Jesus and his love in my life. As my knowledge of certain metaphysical aspects of Jesus' life decreased, my faith in him increased exponentially, and I began to understand and appreciate more fully the wonder of his ministry and the true power of Christ to shape and mold my life. Armed then with the realization that God can speak and move through ideas and myth, and not simply through actual occurrence, my relationship with Mormonism changed dramatically. With such an understanding, all the doctrinal and historical problems of Mormonism became far less important in my spiritual life. So much of traditional Mormon faith is built on a professed belief in the reality of Joseph Smith's first vision or Moroni's visit to the underworld plagues. Yet this reliance on actual occurrence and the attempt to associate these divine actions to some type of earthly event strips them of much of their potential meaning. Does it really matter if Joseph Smith had the first vision or maybe recorded having the first vision? No. The real value of the first vision is in how God can speak to me through this narrative. The same holds true for the Book of Mormon. If one looks carefully at the teachings of the Book of Mormon, one does see value of other sources and an undeniable modern influence. However, one also sees the beauty of this literature and how these borrowed ideas have been expanded and expounded upon. Joseph Smith didn't simply borrow, he enhanced and presented the book full of rich meaning and incredibly deep theology. Therefore, does it matter if the characters in the book actually existed in history? No. A myopic focus on the actual historicity conceals the true wonder that is the Book of Mormon. As I read the Book of Mormon now, with absolutely no concern about its modern influences and historical problems, I am filled with an incredible spirit of love and appreciation for the many ways in which God chooses to teach us and mold us for his divine purposes. I have learned that it is not necessary to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Book of Mormon is divine. Thus, many aspects of Mormonism have become myth or allegory to me, and as a result, I have formed a more intimate and personal relationship with God. Is Joseph Smith still a prophet? Yes, inasmuch as God moved through him to teach incredible things and formed an amazing community of saints. As part of my journey towards Mormon theological liberalism, I read many articles from past issues of Sunstone, listened to past symposium talks, and became a participant in online Mormonism. For the most part, I was delighted with what I found. Others who shared my struggle in doubts, but who, for one reason or another, chose Mormonism. As part of my graduate studies, I spent several months studying ex-Mormonism generally, and ex-Mormon ex-Americans specifically. I did so because I could relate to the feelings of betrayal, anger, frustration, and disappointment often expressed by those who have left the church. As a result, I responded well to thoughtful criticism, but became increasingly uncomfortable with the rhetorical jabs and broad condemnations of the church, especially when such criticisms became personal and in some cases surprisingly uncivil. Armin Ma off the Sunstone talk on viewing the church as a human institution, given in response to the efforts of the Mormon Alliance, have been particularly influential in shaping my views in regard to the church and its leadership. It seems that criticism from some corners condemn the church's claims of near and infallible leadership, while at the same time criticizing the very real and very human imperfection of the church and its leaders. I found this to be inconsistent and unfair, even while I did understand the sentiment. These are important questions, and they should be addressed and discussed. However, the manner in which these issues are discussed is vitally important. Meaningful and productive dialogue can only be achieved in an environment of respect for both sympathy and empathy are present. At the 2008 Salt Lake Symposium, a fellow Latter-day Saint student from Yale attended to listen to my presentation on ex-Mormon narratives. Unfortunately, he was very put off by the tone of several other presentations that has avoided Sunstone ever since. I find this outcome extremely unfortunate and completely unavoidable. Those of us who proclaim Mormon liberalism, both theological and political, and seek full fellowship within the community of saints, cannot expect to be embraced if we do not approach the church, its leaders, and members with respect for both doctrine and culture. In the past, it seems that Mormon liberalism has been defined as contrarian by what Mormon liberalism is not, rather than by what it is. Do the so-called borderlands exist? Absolutely. However, when we find ourselves in borderlands, we must understand that those church members and leaders who we believe have placed us there are, in the vast majority of cases, acting in good faith, seeking to do what they believe is right, just like the rest of us. What I would like to lay out today is a constructive Mormon liberalism I will call Mormon neo-liberalism, an approach to our Mormon faith which works within the context of traditional church culture, tradition, and doctrine. The danger, of course, of theological liberalism is perhaps best expressed by the old joke, what happens when you cross a Mormon at a Unitarian Universalist? The answer is someone who knocks on your door for no reason. Therefore, the first and perhaps most essential aspect of Mormon neo-liberalism is a personal willingness to take a stand, to put a stake in the ground. Of course, this raises an important question. How can an individual take a strong position on Mormon theology and faith when she doubts or questions some of Mormon's fundamental truth claims? I contend that the first step towards taking a position on faith begins by understanding our motivations and desire for association with the LDS Church. Do we love our heritage and find beauty in Latter-day Saint Scripture? Are we putting on appearances for family or for social reasons? Do we enjoy being involved in board service projects, receiving home teachers and attending Sunday services? Whatever the reason, we must work to clearly understand our motivations for seeking fellowship amongst the saints. Without this fundamental understanding, it is difficult, if not impossible, to nurture faith. This is not to say that our motivation can be complex or eloquently articulated. In the New Testament, we read of many who approach Jesus with a little more than curiosity and eloquence. As Alma 32 explains, faith is born of desire. Thus, our motivation is simply a desire. This desire will likely grow into hope, faith, and for some, knowledge. Several years ago, a PhD candidate at Columbia University, a member of a vibrant board in Manhattan, was an avowed atheist but had grown up LDS, was married to an LDS man woman, and had several beautiful children. This man's motivations for fellowship with the saints were primarily based on family and cultural ties. Yet, when asked what his reaction was to difficulty and challenges of both school and home, he answered without hesitation that he asked for guidance and prayer. This man felt drawn to the church, and the saints embraced him. He did not believe in God, but rather hoped that God exists. Despite his doubts regarding metaphysics, this brother recognized his desire to be part of something larger than himself and to contribute as best he could to the needs, both spiritual and temporal, of his fellow Latter-day Saints, most importantly, his family. He took a position. He found something to embrace and did so fully without reservation. This process of identifying our motives is an extremely liberating exercise. It requires serious self-reflection and forces us to examine ourselves in a way we may not have done so previously. To illustrate this point, I will draw from my own experience. Prior to my crisis of faith, I believed that the gospel was the source of my sense of morals and ethics. Commandments define the scope of what both my actions and thoughts should be. When faced with a difficult moral question, I would, in most cases, turn outward to the scriptures and the writings of the prophets. Interestingly, and quite parasitically, I would come through the mirror of forgiveness looking for loopholes When I allowed for the possibility of the gospel, while most certainly providing a valuable moral and spiritual guidance and insight, may not be the singular wellspring of truth and ardor or moral behavior, I felt extremely vulnerable. Through a process that continues to this day, however, I discovered a moral compass illuminated by gospel principles and precepts, but one that required the synthesis of disparate information and the assumption of responsibility for the formulation and articulation of moral principle. This process has been difficult, but extremely rewarding. Now, when I take a moral position, I do so with greater confidence and humility, knowing that my view has been well considered, but is subject to further refinement based on persuasive reasoning and new spiritual insight. In the end, I found that personal reflection and careful reasoning produce sensibilities incredibly similar to what I've been taught in the gospel. This moral alignment, along with the strong spiritual experience, defined my position, that despite its flaws, the church was a force for moral good in the aggregate at one that is owed my service and support. I also discovered that the church fulfilled a great spiritual need, and I look forward to associating each week with individuals seeking out divine meaning and purpose. My life has been greatly blessed by those from the church who take Alma's admonition of Alma's anxiety team to heart. My burdens have been light, have been made light, and I have been comforted during difficult times. It is, of course, our human nature to identify the negative, the problems, and the difficulties faced by any organization. Yet, if we choose to affiliate exclusively with persons or organizations that we perceive to be without flaw, our lives will be quite lonely. Difficulty presents opportunities for growth. And if we choose to affiliate with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we have an obligation to serve our fellow saints as best we can. Once we have taken a position, regardless of what that position may be, we must be honest with our families, our fellow saints, and most importantly, ourselves. This is not to say we should stand up and confess and testimony to present a longer list of doubts. Rather, we should be judicious in how, when, and where we express certain views. Sunday services are not academic conferences on Mormon studies. Therefore, discussing Joseph's polyandry or bringing him to whiskey still may not be appropriate during Sunday school. It is essential to remember the intended purpose of any gathering or meeting. If our actions do not align with the purposes for which others have come together to worship in faith, our flippant or careless words will only serve to cause unnecessary discomfort for no purpose other than to serve our own egos. We become no better than the brother who seems to hijack every Sunday school lesson with theories on co-op and recitation before the fee works being done. Of course, were it not for doubts, concerns, and questions, there would be no need for theological liberalism. Honesty is a two-way street. It is our obligation to express concerns and raise important issues in an appropriate and constructive manner. I can think of no better example of this type of action than the response to Julie Beck's Mothers Who Never Talk, given in 2007, What Women Know. What Women Know, Justice Beck's original talk, is flawed, a fact I'm sure its authors and supporters would readily acknowledge. Yet the response drips with raw sincerity as it positively affirms and acknowledges both the challenges and opportunities facing modern women. Many of Sister Beck's assertions about the role of women in motherhood are challenged, but Sister Beck was not personally attacked or criticized. What Women Know is not a purely contrarian document. Rather, it promotes a positive view of women while at the same time expressing respect and concern over the sentiment shared by Sister Beck. Again, What Women Know is an excellent example of expressing concern over church-related issues in a constructive manner designed to encourage dialogue and avoid demagoguery. As individuals, we have an obligation to be honest about our views with local church leaders. By expressing our doubts along with our desire to affiliate with the church and its members, local leaders will be best able to help us identify opportunities to serve. When I first expressed doubts to my bishop in Manhattan, he responded with incredible love and compassion that did not hide the fact that his desire was to someday belief and knowledge supply and ambiguity. Although only in my early 30s, the bishop asked me to attend the high priest group and expressly told me to go in and shake things up. I was invited to teach the high priest group on a somewhat regular basis, and many of my most cherished spiritual experiences occurred in the fellowship of those kind men. One of the most surprising results of becoming an open Mormon liberal is what I would consider pastoral opportunities to speak with church members who struggle in silence, fearing that they are alone in their search for direction and meaning after a crisis of their faith. These members simply want to be heard and to know others have experienced similar difficulties. In 2008, I argued that Mormon liberals have an obligation to be more open and transparent. One of the most heartbreaking aspects of the ex-Mormon experience is the sense of isolation felt by many who eventually decide to leave the church. Often, it is only after having fully removed themselves from church fellowship that these individuals recognize the existence of Mormon liberalism and see it as a viable option to full abandonment of the church. By remaining silent, we perpetuate the myth of Mormon orthodoxy. All Mormons are cafeteria Mormons. Orthodoxy and creeds are anathema to the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, and yet, we have allowed our culture to be permeated by this insidious notion that Mormon belief is strictly and narrowly defined. Leaving the church can be an incredibly painful experience, and as we have seen during this very symposium, individuals can and do return to the fellowship of the saints. As Mormon liberals, it is our responsibility to comfort those who stand in need of comfort and mourn with those who are mourning their own loss of belief. By no means am I suggesting that ex-Mormonism does not provide a path. For some, leaving the church is the right choice. However, any member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who chooses to leave the fold should do so knowing that they are loved, that they will be missed, and that they are not alone in the struggle. Finally, Mormon liberals must recognize that membership in the church in part constitutes implicit social contract governing dynamics of interaction. As such, there are several aspects of this social contract that should be noted as being of particular importance. First, the church is not a democracy, nor has it ever claimed to be democratic. I know a few conservative religions where democratic process rules the day. For evangelicals, final authority rests with the Bible. The Latter-day Saints, the First Presidency, holds final authority governing church doctrine and policy. Both during and after the Prop 8 controversy, some church members asked me if I denied that President Watson had the authority to commit the institutional church to a particular social policy. My response was yes, President Watson had full authority and every right to set church policy and define the scope of church political activity, just as I have full authority and every right to express my personal support of gay marriage and define the scope of my own political activity. Respecting the authority of both general and local leaders to attend to their church stewardship is essential to maintaining a healthy and productive relationship with the church as an institution and its individual members. Second, because liberal theological views already place us at the margins of Mormon society, we must remember that kindness and charity and words and actions should be our default position. At some point in our Mormon experience, church members may question our faith, our dedication, and our worthiness, and in most of our lives, allow me to pronounce the status of our eternal souls. Such instances present an opportunity to exercise patience and charity. Third, expressions of concern or disagreement with individual church leaders are most effectively presented within the confines of the church itself. If our bishop says or does something we find objectionable, we should relay our concerns to the state president and so on up the bureaucratic line. If we feel compelled to make our criticisms or concerns public, we should not be surprised when the institutional church reacts defensively. Each of us must follow our conscience and pursue issues we deem important. Before doing so, however, we should be aware that the consequences of our actions are likely to set in motion. To conclude, I wish to reiterate my contention that Mormon liberals can and should be a powerful force for good within the church. There is no reason for us to volunteer to sit on the sidelines or to allow ourselves to be pushed into irrelevance. It is my sincere hope and prayer that all who seek communion with the saints will find it and enjoy the comfort and blessings such communion.
As I try to feel my way, I'm just wondering how people get
missionary days and talk about what Paul talks about being the Spirit. For me, it's more. It was kind of like that experience of when I had my original crisis of faith. And I said, "Well, does God even exist?" What it took was reflection. I think in the Book of Mormon, we hear several times prophets encouraging people to remember. And I think remembering is an important part of coming to understand our current place within the church. So as I reflected on my past experience in the church, on all the incredible experiences I had, how grateful I was for the upbringing that it provided, for the work ethic it provided, for the example of my ancestors and the sacrifices they made, it brought a tremendous sense of, I'm not sure how to, appreciation, I think would be the word. And so, I think the only way to describe it is this collective experience of a spiritual experience, knowing that this was my place. I mean, I did look elsewhere. I said, well, can I be a liberal Lutheran or perhaps a Methodist? So attended services there. Went, of course, was very involved in chapel services at Yale, which were held every day. And while those were fantastic, I absolutely loved, the experience and learned a lot, I never felt like that was my home. But when I went to sacrament meeting, even though it's boring, even though there's no liturgy to speak of, and the talks are awful most of the time, I felt at home there. And because my focus was on service now rather than on truth, because I had grown up LDS, I think that I realized I could be most effective as a servant of God within the context of the church, because I knew the church, I knew its language, I knew how to phrase things so as not to be offensive, what certain terms meant, right? Whereas if I switched gears and changed, I would have had no idea and this been completely ineffective. So I think it was a combination of all those things where I just felt at peace knowing that my place was in the LDS church. I think that's the best way to describe it. It's just a sense of peace and a sense of being at home when I was worshiping with the saints.
Thanks. It was really valuable to hear that. A lot of what you said resonated with me. As I try to wonder how much involvement I should try to have, and I'm inspired by people like you, I really like statements about how we can create meaning, we can change lives without worrying about historicity, and that it's good to be honest yet judicious in what we share. My concern is for people like me that are not only less literal with the history, but actually more materialist rather than spiritual, I can agree that that values come from somewhere other than the commandments, etc., and that goodness and charity and service are all things that are available to all humans, and I feel like I have something to give as well as to receive. The question I have is, in trying to be honest with other people, even judiciously, how far can you go before even your good, applicable input is discounted? Because it, obviously, if you're not expecting an answer to your prayer in these ways, then what do we have to learn from you? Kind of expectation. Thanks.
Yeah, another great question. Thank you. So for the longest time, when I said, so after my crisis, I had a period where I had disengaged from the church for a while and tried to find my place. And then in 2009, I made the conscious effort to return back. In that conversation, I had my bishop, that I heard this in my talk, I had to express where I was coming from. And even though while at church, I wouldn't openly describe myself as a non-believer, that was the term that I would employ. I would say, well, I'm a Mormon. A couple months ago in February, I had lunch do hope, I wish that the Mormon was historical. I do hope that families can be kept forever and that, you know, those things are true. That would be absolutely wonderful. And right now, I don't think so, based on what I've done, but that would be fantastic. And you know what? It could be, right? You knock yourself to a pyramid tomorrow and say you're completely wrong. Right? I have to be open to that possibility. So I think that we just have to be. The problem is if you say to a Mormon, "I'm a non-believer," what they hear, because Mormonism is so central to a person's sense of being and defines who they are, I think that can be perceived as an attack on them as a person, even though it's not intended that way. So when you're saying, "Well, I don't believe in the history of the Book of Mormon," they're going to take it very personally because that's such a personal part of what they do. So I've adjusted my language. I found it to be much more effective, but still at the same time honest that I hope the Book of Mormon is true. I don't know. I hope it is. And hope is faith. So I don't describe myself as a non-believer anymore. I mean, if someone wants to get down with me and really have an in-depth discussion, sure, I'll open up about what that means exactly. But when talking to the general church membership, when talking about where I am, what I believe, you know, I say I hope. I don't get up. In fact, I will often get up and fast at a customer meeting and express my gratitude and my hope and my belief in the love of God and all these things. I do not use the word no because I don't know. So that's what I found to be most effective. And the other thing I'll add to that is, and I think this is also part of being honest, I have a mentor, good scotch and cigars. And I love my home teachers. And when they would come, right, and of course, I've been to a lot of other home service projects. Of course, I've taught priest group, but you know, all these brothers are for church. And of course, I'm not getting up like I said, I'm getting up and say, well, I don't look at Gitter and Blitz and all that kind of stuff, right? And they would come home and teach me and see my humidor and my scotch collection. You know, what's going on? So I think for me, it was important that, you know, if I had felt compelled to hide that right part of my life, I didn't feel that way, right? And actually, in this case, I think it was a learning experience for my teachers, because they learned that, oh, you can still be serving an active Mormon and love the community and all that, but you don't have to completely be Orthodox, right? But having said that, I don't really want to ask for a temple recommend either, because I know I'm going to be asked for a religion, I'm not going to lie. So I think there's a balance you have to strike, and I think it really depends on the dynamics of your board. And also on the level of what you're comfortable in sharing and saying, do you believe or don't believe, or what you hope for. And if you find that you hope for certain things, then yeah, people love to hear that. And that's where it all starts. And I firmly believe that if the judgment bar of God, if I end up being completely wrong, as long as we can answer to ourselves that we are approaching things in a way that we feel is honest and true and is the best of our ability, using all the gifts that our Heavenly Father's given us. I have a feeling that Heavenly Father's going to be very kind. And I think other church members as well, too. And yeah, some are going to be obnoxious, but whatever, right? You can't avoid that. So, anyway, I don't know if that addresses everything.
That's perfect. So you've kind of already talked about this, but you said in previous and some session, you talked about how... So in a previous session, you were talking about how liberal Mormons seem to be... You're making the argument that liberal Mormons seem to be more open. So I would just like you to talk a little bit more about that, and how can you do that without causing strife or contention or even losing your credibility with the community that you love?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is the setting in which you find yourself. So, Sunday school, like I mentioned, is not a symposium on Mormon studies. So, if there are things that are brought up and mentioned that you disagree with, there are ways to discuss it. I mean, you have to ask yourself, am I going to contribute to the spiritual growth of anyone in this room by adding whatever I want to say right now? And if the answer is no, then it's probably best to leave it unsaid. And because there are
plenty of forums to express those opinions, blogs and discussion boards and whatnot. There's ways to get out there. As far as the issue of credibility, I think it comes down to tone. One day at Sunday school, when we're studying the Old Testament, there's that horrific story about the genocide of the Amalekites. And the teacher, sweet teacher, and she just told the story, but so nonchalant, right? Ordered the slaughter. And I raised my hand and I said, "Boy, I really hope this is one of those biblical verses that's mistranslated." And she pressed me a little bit on it, and I said, I got to tell you, if the Lord told me to slaughter the Amalekites, I probably would have said no. And people were kind of shocked. They looked at me and said, "How would you say no? Is the Lord telling you to do something?" I said, "Well, I'd want a second opinion." And I said, "The reason is not because I don't trust the Lord. I do. What I don't trust is my ability to understand what He's telling me." I would not be comfortable making that type of decision. So again, I was kind of pushing the envelope a little bit there, but I didn't want to push it so far to create discomfort or anything like that. Now afterwards, interestingly, I had like five people come up to me and say, "Well, I'm so glad you said that, because that passage has always bothered me," right? So I think if we can find constructive ways to raise issues about certain things, for example, when I've taught high priest group and whatnot, mentioning the theology of Jonathan Edwards Jr. that's present in the Book of Mormon, that was a fascinating subject. I mean, people were really intrigued by that, but also we have to recognize that Joseph Smith took that and the way it's presented in the Book of Mormon is not just a repetition of Jonathan Edwards, it's Jonathan Edwards plus, right? There's something more to it. And that was the point, right? So I think it really just depends on your audience. And I think the overarching theme needs to be, why is everyone here? Are they here to be uplifted spiritually, or are they here to maybe discuss some interesting and challenging issues? And that should set the tone of how to respond, I think. And so far, so good. I've had one eligible president doesn't like me very well. I don't even like it, just like talking to me. Other than that, I've been fully embraced, no problems at all, because I'm not there to make anybody else a member. I'm there to worship and do the best I can to serve anyone.
I know you're here to listen to Seth. I'm Seth's very old friend from high school, and I just wanted to add something to what you guys are asking. So I don't agree with 80% of what Seth says, but the reason that we have relationships is because I know that He loves me. And so for you who are trying to find your place in your board, start, like you said, with service. That's why you're there, right? To help and serve other people. And if they feel from you a sincere desire to love and serve them, then whatever you say to them, they will understand this in the context of their feelings for you. And that they understand that you are saying these things to them because you love and care about them, and you want them to grow spiritually and to experience the kind of deep spiritual experiences that Seth has experienced. So I think for those of you who want to maintain your membership in your ward, but you're unsure how, I think that it starts with relationships. And if I were you, I would start by reaching out and serving and loving each person individually that you see in your Sunday school class, especially those that you know you're going to disagree with, so that later you can disagree with them in a way that is appropriate, and that they will know where you're coming from because they have already understood you and your relationship to them. So start with the relationship, grow the relationship, and then express, as you see fit in appropriate ways, your views and feelings about the church and its doctrine. So start with love and service, and then it will be a comfortable conversation when you have it.
Well,
liberal venue like that. Many years I taught at BYU-Idaho, and I can tell you how it works up there. If you have one student that perceives that you are speaking about something that is not church-approved or not faith-promoting, that kid will leapfrog. He won't even go to your department chair. He will go right to the president. Now, I know it's a little different in a war context and coming out to family members and coming out to people in your Sunday school class, but you mentioned talk to your bishop if he says something that offends you. I would just like you to elaborate a little more on your experience with that and what you see as the dynamics of the local authority who see you as something to control.
I was very fortunate to be living in New York than I did when I decided to re-engage in full activity in church. My bishop, John Moe, is actually a fashion photographer in New York, and he takes what many Mormons would consider risque photographs. And he told me the story, and I expressed it where I was from church. He told me the story of when he was called as bishop. You may have heard of Brent Bell after he was president of the New York State for quite a while. He's a very conservative Latinx. And Bishop Moe told me that he could tell that President Bell now was a little uncomfortable, and that this was not his first choice for bishop. So the bishop could relate, in a sense, to where I was coming from. People often ask me, well, could you pull out what you do at the Board of Utah? And I don't know. I don't know if I could or not. And I think that, well, let me rephrase. Yes, I could, because I personally don't really care what other people say about my kind of past. I realize that. And to be really comfortable with my own spirituality. But I'm also in a unique position where I'm never going to be called as a bishop. Unless something weird happens. I never expected to be called to teach Sunday school or to give a sacrament or talk or whatever. People know me where I was coming from. So, for me, it became, I really had to focus on where are the commonalities and how can I express those as often as possible. Now, do some church leaders overstep their bounds, especially at the local level? Yes, they do. And what can we do in those cases? Well, we can go to a sacred rest. And if we have trouble there, we can go off the line. And I know from personal experience that there are general leaders of the church who are happy to listen to his concerns and are very concerned that members like myself are being marginalized at the local level. And while it's going to, nothing happens quickly in Mormonism. And so it's going to take a while for the culture to change if it does change. But I sense that it is. When I spoke to a general authority as part of my research into ex-Mormonism, the phrase that he used is that we need to have big arms in the church. And you need to be welcome. Everyone needs to be welcome. We need to do that. So I think there is a sense at the top that there needs to be. People need to be embraced, but let's be realistic. If a bishop gets called and happens to be pretty zealous and whatnot, and making life difficult, or it's not possible for you to serve, or he's marginalizing you or trying to control you, well, you can go to another board. You can maybe find another way to worship. I think that you just have to follow the dictates of the Spirit at that point. I don't know if there's any particular way. I don't know how to say how to handle that except just following your own consciousness. The BYU situation is not one I expect. That's what we're talking about.
I hope, because we have some time, I don't have a direct question, but I have some endorsement of some things that you said. In terms of rather than spewing out your arguments and maybe attacks on a blog or somewhere else, I've really had success with addressing to whom it may concern directly. And even though from the pulpit we sometimes get advice, don't be writing to general authorities. We had a general authority at the Speak to Our State Conference, and it was him that I had an issue with, so I wrote to him. And it was a well-considered letter, I think, and well-written, and I wasn't personally offended. However, I felt like he was insensitive, and there was, I think it was an assumption that everyone was married, that there weren't single parents, you know, that, and I just thought his message would be more effective as he travels around the church, if he showed more sensitivity to a diverse family situations, that was reality, and he would be more powerful in his calling. So I wrote that because I felt like that was part of my integrity. I felt like it needed to be expressed. And he was the person, not my neighbor, not somebody in church. He was the one. And I had no expectation of hearing from him. And I got a very nice, respectful, appreciative letter acknowledging what I said and acting like, well, I'm right. I need to do a little course correction here. And then more recently, my state president is one of Bruce Summer Conkey's youngest sons, and though I'm distantly related to him, we do butt heads. I hope we have a good chemistry over at the place. If I get a little tired, I feel like he worships Joseph Smith, and that's always part of what he says. And he may be fine, and it's my problem, but it always rankles me a little bit. But recently, he spoke to our ward conference, and I had a real problem with what he said. It felt like an attack on the Jews to me, and that was offensive. And it was hard for me not to walk out, but he's open with his email address, and I emailed him. And I was very, first I wrote a big old thing and told him how to give an effective sacrament. Don't talk after someone like you shouldn't be talking out of the cup. And I was glad that actually some of you might know Mark Thomas, and gratefully he said, for one thing, it's too long, he doesn't have time to read that. So I sent him something much shorter, and wondered what the fallout of that would be. I got a very short response, and I don't know that I believe him completely, but I appreciate his sentiment. He said, "No one feels worse than I do about what I said." And that is the last thing I expected to hear. And I have cried on several occasions talking about how everybody said. So I have a hard time believing he shed as many tears as I did, but who knows. And talking about President McConkey, he also said something that I think ties in with something that was said here, I think, by you, that was one of the most powerful things he's ever said to me. And he really talked about it more in a missionary context. He's a university professor, and so talking about how he has talked to non-members up there. But I think it's powerful for some of us too. He says, "But would you, okay, this is a crazy story about Joseph Smith and the Golden Plate, but wouldn't it be nice if it were true? Wouldn't you like?" And so that idea, like, yeah, I'd like to believe. And so it was interesting that he used it. And it's for me, even though, like I said, he was saying it in what we call maybe a missionary context, I think for sure that's the most powerful thing I've ever heard from the pulpit of my president, McConkey. Also, I really appreciate you advocating honesty, and honesty with our leaders, I think. And I know people that will know that they might have trouble in a temple, recommend, interview, and so they stick with a yes-no kind of thing. And I really, and this is my experience, and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like, I can't remember, it's been a long time since I've been through the interview process, but there's one question about, I don't know, to get along with all your fellow, I don't know what it was. And I said, well, I've gotten mad at my kids before. And to me, that was an honest answer, and he kind of poo-pooed that, like, we don't expect that kind of honesty, or that's, but I really think whatever, I mean, just to be, I think you need to do that for yourself, for one thing, and I believe like you, that most of our leaders are acting in good faith, and that most of them can take that kind of honesty, and I know from other people's experience that a friend of mine said, her when asked if Mrs. Walsh was apologizing for swearing in front of her bishop in an interview, I mean, that's how she's expressing herself. And he said, "No, you know what? That's a refreshing kind of honesty. I don't get." And you think, gosh, maybe it must be good timing as a bishop to hear people just go, "Oh yeah, I did that, and I did that, and I'm so good, and I believe, and I know." And how refreshing, perhaps, it is for them to hear somebody say their honest responses to some of the questions. And just one last thing, I think you stress tone, and I think that's really powerful. And also, what your example gave in your Sunday school, gospel class, I guess, the humor that you instilled, and that to me, I think there's power in that. And also the kind of humor that you use, I think that helps diffuse the message and the contention.
Thank you.